Good evening, truth seekers. Hey, aren't you glad it's Friday? Oh my God. Welcome to the program. 7 past the hour. Hang around for a while tonight, okay? We will shake your branches and see what falls out. Yeah, it's been a strange week, another strange week. Tonight I have some really good emails from listeners I want to share with you because, sometimes the stuff that comes rolling in here in the form of emails is so much better than what I put together. And it's good stuff. However, before we really get cranked, somebody sent me, who sent me this? Damn, I don't even know. Oh, well. John Bolton, remember him? Bush's ambassador to the United Nations for a while. He was a recess appointment. And it was Greg in Wisconsin that sent this to me. He was a recess appointment because even the crazy people in the Senate knew that Bolton was insane, and he never would have been confirmed. Bolton was one of the original group of Project for a New American Century. He's a real advocate of death and destruction. He just defines a warmongering psychopath as long as it's a war that he thinks he won't be involved in. I think Bolton wants to be one of the people that triggers a nuclear war. Of course, he doesn't understand that in doing so, he commits suicide. I don't think Bolton gives a damn, but he's so many of the people that are right-wingers, Republicans, or conservatives are sick. Have you noticed that? I mean, they are just absolutely sick. That's why I don't see how their message gets any traction in this country, except for the fact that so many millions of people in this country are equally sick, right? Anyway, this is from the Madison Independent Examiner, and it's picked up by examiner.com. He has a novel idea, Bolton does, of ensuring peace in the Middle East, and that would be a nuclear first strike on Iran. During a conference, University of Chicago, sponsored by the University of Young Republicans and Chicago Friends of Israel, ironically entitled Ensuring Peace, Bolton said the following, quote, negotiations have failed, and so too have sanctions. So we're at a very unhappy point, where unless Israel is prepared to use nuclear weapons against Iran's program, Iran will have nuclear weapons in the very near future, end quote. Now, you'll notice that he avoided explicitly advocating the use of nuclear weapons by Israel and Iran. But the logical conclusion of his statement is clear. If negotiations have failed, and he states that they have, then a nuclear first strike by Israel on Iran's nuclear power plants is justifiable. He fails to mention that Iran shares a border with Russia, the country that helped Iran build those facilities, and a country that actually does possess nuclear weapons capable of striking the U.S. and Israel. But Bolton is a deathmonger. There are peacemongers, there are warmongers, there are crazy people, and then there are deathmongers. What John Bolton always wanted during the Bush years and tried his goddamnedest to bring to fruition is mass death on the planet. And so many of the people in the so-called conservative neocon, neo-fascist, whatever you want to call them, movement. I'm talking about the ones that speak American, like John Bolton. They are deathmongers. They had this screwy idea that I don't know. The religious crazies believe that enough death will bring their Messiah. The political crazies believe that enough death will weed out the Earth's population, get it down to maybe a billion and a half, and then it could start all over. Of course, they don't realize with that kind of death, the planet becomes uninhabitable. So they're mad. These are mad men. And with the exception of a couple of women, they're all men. But they're mad. They're insane. Just insane. So it's curious what negotiations Bolton is referring to. You know, when he says negotiations have failed, what negotiations? Christ, we don't even talk to him, the Iranians. Neither does Israel. What's he talking about? what negotiations is he talking about, right? Negotiations, the U.S. under, what's his name, Bush, and even under Obama, the negotiations have consisted of the U.S. saying to Iran, you won't do that. You're not going to do that. God damn it. No, no, you're not going to do it. That's negotiations. That's negotiations. Iran has already agreed to inspections of its nuclear facilities by the IAEA, and Iran is a signatory of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Israel, on the other hand, who Bolton wants to inspire to attack, Israel is not a signatory of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and Israel has not allowed inspectors to come into its nuclear facilities. You see the madness here? Of course you do. Now, I know, spare me. Don't call me an anti-Semite. Oh, Jesus, please stop. Oh, my God. Do you see the craziness here? The absolute craziness. Now, it may not seem crazy to Americans that are paying attention to the degree that most Americans pay attention. Well, Israel's got nuclear weapons, so what? They got to have them to keep the peace. Well, what about Iran? Nuclear weapons to keep the peace only works if the idea of mutual assured destruction is at hand. You see? Now, that doesn't work anymore, because when you have stateless people who are willing to commit suicide, who are willing to take a nuclear weapon and drop it somewhere, then the whole thing breaks down. But Iran and Israel, for example, if they both were armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, neither one would attack. Right? Of course not. Just like the United States and the Soviet Union. For how many years? 50 years? 5 decades? 6 decades? Didn't attack each other. And we had people in this country early on in the nuclear arms race who tried to pressure Truman and Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson into nuking the Soviet Union. I mean, I'm sure there were people inside the Soviet Union doing the same thing. We got to kill the Amerikanskis. But, you know, cooler heads prevailed. Not cooler heads, but other heads prevailed that said, no, wait a second. If we get them, they get us. Even if they don't get us. If we drop 20, 30, 40, 50 nuclear bombs, we're all dead anyway. This is madness. Okay. Hence the name, MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. So John Bolton apparently was off the planet Earth when all this stuff went on for 50 years. A crazy son of a bitch. So now he's suggesting, in his oblique, kind of smarmy way with that phony mustache he wears, wouldn't you like to just rip it off him? I would. I really would. He's suggesting that now that everything is broken out with Iran, the only way to ensure peace is to launch a nuclear attack on Iran. Now tell me if that's not insane. And by the way, as I said, he was one of the original people in the Project for a New American Century that advocating Big Brother approach from Orwell's novel, the Big Brother approach, endless war, always war. Doesn't make any difference who we're fighting against, East Asia, Eurasia, doesn't matter. Endless war. Reports sent from the front lines today. Another 5,000 Eurasians killed by the power of the little bump bump. And steel production is up. However, we're going to cut back on the chocolate ration. Just on and on and on and on. Nuclear war. O'Brien. Oops. Nuclear war, Bolton says. Gregory Patton writes at theexaminer.com, it is nothing new for John Bolton or any of his neoconservative cohorts to advocate an Israeli strike against Iran. What is new, however, is the use of the word nuclear, especially in the context of a conference about ensuring peace. Ah, my God. We are chock-a-block with insane people who truly, honestly, deeply want to destroy everything. And see, I believe there should be a panel somewhere of very wise men and women, maybe from a different, maybe one of those parallel dimensions you're always talking about, a very wise panel of men and women from a parallel dimension who have been observing us for all eternity, who will say, okay, we're going to put these people on trial and give them a trial and then remove them. Take them over to a different dimension so that right here and now it appears like they've just disappeared. Wouldn't that be a good idea? Scared beyond belief. of the Mike Malloy program is brought to you by It's Up to Us Alone, featuring Ed Asner. Go to usalone.com for information on where to hear the debut of this dramatic new radio play in your area. Coming up at the bottom of the hour tonight, and the second and third hours also, podcast trivia, where we'll be giving away three more subscriptions free to the Malloy program podcast downloads, commercial free. And all urine. There was one other addition here that Greg Patton at Madison Independent Examiner had written. It's right at the end. He writes, an Israeli nuclear strike on Iran is highly unlikely without U.S. approval, and there undoubtedly are saner minds in the administration that would prevail. But the mere suggestion of a nuclear first strike should wake people up to the fact that maniacs like Bolton, who would risk starting World War III, are given airtime in our media and access to our young minds. And these rat bastards get upset when Barack Obama wants to give a video address to kids in school. Bolton goes to the University of Chicago to an event sponsored by Young Republicans. Any young Republican who agrees with Bolton is not a young Republican at all. He is, first of all, he's the walking dead, or she. Plus, they are neo-fascists. I mean, come on. Oh, well. This is from Lindsay in Seattle, who writes, Mike, love your show, and I have a few thoughts about the Louisiana judge who refused to issue marriage license to interracial couples that I'd like to share with you. First, I'd like to say that when I first read about this on Huffington Post, I thought it was some kind of joke. I really couldn't believe that this could be happening now. Of course, I live in Seattle, so maybe I just don't know how it is in the South. But man, this just seemed like going too far, even for the rural American South. At any rate, I was totally shocked and really appalled at this man's actions, and even more so at his comments in defense of his actions. I thought that the comment he made about letting black people use his bathroom was very telling. It just seemed like a very strange thing to say unless one is racist, and then it becomes a perfectly reasonable thing to say. Could you imagine a black person saying the same thing about a white person? Oh, yes, I let white people use my bathroom. That makes me a good person. It doesn't have the same historic implications because, of course, when white and black bathrooms were segregated, the white people got the better bathrooms. They got the better everything. So specifically mentioning bathrooms seems like something someone would say if they were trying to point out how charitable they are and their mind is still in the segregation era. Also, I'm sure he doesn't understand that when he says, I'm not racist, I just don't think the races should be mixing that way, you know, getting married. He's expressing two diametrically opposed ideas. It's like he just said, I don't have anything against cookies. I just don't think that flour, eggs, sugar, and baking soda should be mixed that way. You can't have cookies without mixing those ingredients. Just as you have racism, unless you believe that the races should be allowed to mix any way they damn well please. A favorite battle cry for those who seek control of others is, won't somebody please think of the children? From this wingnut who is apparently stuck in the Jim Crow South, to the anti-choice zealots, to the anti-gay marriage freaks, to those who would bar gay people from adopting children who otherwise would have no loving home to go to, they always claim that they have the best interests of children at heart. But they don't. They have their own perceived best interests at heart. And that is all. Lindsay in Seattle. Plus, they're insane. It never fails to amaze me when I stop to think about it, which I try not to do a whole lot, because if I think about it too much, I want to go get in bed, pull the covers over my head, and just stay there for, 6 months? And I have a 5-year-old and a wife, and I can't do that. So I try not to think about how crazed people are in this country, how sick the right-wingers who on talk radio and talk television. If you stop and think about, and I realize I mention this all the time, but mentioning it is one time, when you really gauge it, when you take the measure of how much poison is being injected into the society on a daily basis, the surprise is not that there is such a dividing line between normal people and crazy people in the society, the crazies being on the right, of course. The surprise is that the normal people haven't all gotten together one night, millions of us, and said, you know what? In order for this country to survive, we've got to surround the crazy people and eliminate them. That's the surprise to me. You know, you can make the argument, well, Mike, every society has had its crazy people. Yeah, and usually, saner minds prevail. Even among the ranks of the crazy, they will get to a point where they'll say, you know, maybe we're being too crazy. Let's dial it back just a little bit. You know, like in the Reagan years, there were people in the Reagan years who were mad, screwed up, but they dialed it back a little bit. They did most of their work behind the scenes. But behind the scenes doesn't exist anymore. There is no curtain behind which the little man who is Oz operates. It's all out in the open. The crazy is out in the open, which should make it easier to target.
Excuse me, ma'am. The species has amused itself to death.
Just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Okay, Kathy, I say it's time that we break up this madness and let's do a little podcast trivia, if you will. Every time I say "if you will" or hear it said, I think of the killer. You know who I'm talking about. Hi, Ziggy in Omaha, Nebraska.
How you doing this evening, Mike?
I'm okay. You've tried before, haven't you?
Yeah, hopefully third time's the charm.
Okay. Are you ready?
Yes, sir.
All right, here we go. During the Hurricane Katrina nightmare and immediate aftermath, where was Condoleezza Rice? Was she A, playing piano at a Republican fundraising, B, on the ground in New Orleans assisting victims on relocation, C, shopping for shoes at Ferragamo's on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, or D, meeting with foreign leaders in Geneva?
Oh. I'm going to go with a guess on this, and that's probably A.
Playing piano at a Republican fundraiser?
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry, Ziggy. You can try again. She was at Ferragamo's on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan shopping for shoes, which is obviously where she belonged, right? All right, here we go. Daryl is in Las Vegas. Hi, Daryl.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Pretty good. All right, you ready to do this?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay, here we go. Who was Jeff Gannon? Was he A, Dick Cheney and Ann Coulter's love child, B, Bush's White House chief of staff, C, Bush's private secretary, or D, a male escort and phony White House reporter who is hired to lob softball questions at press briefings.
Oh, man. Can you read over B and C for me?
Yeah, B was Bush's White House chief of staff. C was Bush's private attorney. A, Dick Cheney's love child with Ann Coulter. And D, a male escort and phony White House reporter who was hired to lob softball questions at press briefings. Who was Jeff Gannon?
Oh, that's the hard one. I'm going to just go with, how about C?
C? No! Oh, come on, Daryl. It was D, the male escort and phony White House reporter. His real name was Jeff Guckert. He first attended the White House press conference on February 20th, 2003, and he asked a question of then-White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer. At the time he asked that question, Guckert had never had an article published. He was not associated with any kind of news organization. The so-called Talon News had not yet been created. However, he said that he was an editor of his high school student newspaper as proof of having some journalistic experience. I mean, just a complete ass. All right, come on, people. I surely thought you would get the Condoleezza Rice one. I surely thought you would get the Jeff Gannon one. Now, come on. Let's snap two here. Jerry is in Jackson, Ohio. Right?
Hi.
Is that you, Jerry?
Yes.
Okay. Are you ready?
I got the first two right, but it wasn't my turn.
It wasn't. Well, it always helps if it's your turn, right? Okay. Here we go. The Bush administration's many abuses of power have caused many pundits and this program host to compare the Bush administration to the plot of what famous novel? Was it A, Camus' The Stranger, B, Orwell's 1984, C, Huxley's Brave New World, or D, Dr. Seuss's Hop on Pop?
Can you go through that again?
Yeah. A, Camus' The Stranger, B, Orwell's 1984, C, Huxley's Brave New World, or D, Hop on Pop by Dr. Seuss?
I'm going to say C.
Huxley's Brave New World? Oh, no, Jerry. It was 1984. I even read the whole thing on the air. Oh, my goodness. Come on, people. I can't believe that we are not. Come on, is it that long ago that these thugs were in office and all this stuff happened? Okay, we're going to try. Let's try one more.
No, I mean, I'm not going to have
enough. You want to wait till next hour because everybody screwed up the easy ones?
You get three shots.
All right, well, the boss here says you get three shots per hour, listeners, and you had all three. Come on, people. These are not hard. Well, I guess they are. I don't know. You know, from our perspective, they're not hard, but, okay. Let's move on to, our missive tonight from Prairie 2, who writes, Mike, Bank of America lost $1 billion in the last quarter, and this gave Wall Street pause today. Traders were milling about, pawing at the ground, not sure which way to run. One silly metaphor is as good as another when describing this circus. These masters of the universe are supposed to be the experts on how business works and how money is made. Yet the only businesses that are making money are these giant, too big to fail Wall Street banks. You don't have to look very close to figure out that these banks aren't really making any money at all. Their profits are entirely from trading. You know, like churning the stock market or driving up the price of gasoline. Anything that they do that must interact with the real economy is hemorrhaging money. Credit cards can't be written off fast enough, and home mortgage defaults that were already high are up another 20%. In the next 3 hours, 1,300 Americans will lose their homes to foreclosure. Bank of America actually posted $9.6 billion in permanent losses tied to an array of bad debt, including mortgages, home equity loans, credit cards, and loans tied to commercial real estate. The thing is that this still doesn't reveal how bad things really are, since banks can wait months or even years to declare a loan uncollectible after the payments stop coming in. Home lenders still haven't revealed the extent of their exposure to loans that have a variable rate and have yet to reset, or the interest-only loans that are going further and further underwater. Credit cards have had their interest jacked up to beat the new federal rules, and this will put more people into default. They are trillions in the hole, not because of the crash, but because they have been creating this bubble for years to hide their losses. They were taking hundreds of billions in bonuses and paying interest on bonds held by rich people like the Bush family, when in fact they weren't doing anything that made money. It's been a 30-year Ponzi scheme, and they don't see any reason to stop now. Welcome to the Ponzi-onomy. Ponzi-economy, the Ponzi-onomy. As always, prairienumeral2.com. Isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth? What the hell do banks create, especially now? Nothing. They're not giving money for businesses and home loans and shopping centers and malls and skyscrapers and condominiums. What are they doing? What is Goldman Sachs doing that it has a rat hole, $23 billion, that it's going to pay? Do you know the, I think I read today, 130,000 employees of Goldman Sachs are going to get an average of $700,000 a piece as a bonus. Now, don't you want to just slit somebody's throat over that? I do. I have to admit to it. It just makes me crazy. Makes me absolutely insane. We are in desperate straits, and yet Goldman Sachs is going to pay out $23 billion in bonuses to people that have done what? What have they done? What have these people done? They've traded debt back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, jacked up future commodity prices. Is Goldman Sachs loaning money? To whom? Where? Well, I was talking to a friend today, Chuck, who's in this business, more or less, in the building business. And he's really hit a brick wall here with money drying up, with investments going. I mean, there's nowhere to go, nowhere to go. And in the course of our conversation, we were talking about how everything is illusion. It's madness, and the bankers are cutting nobody any slack. When you read this stuff about the stock market's over 10,000, that doesn't mean a damn thing. It means nothing. It means absolutely bat snot. Nothing. Oh, well. Last night was the last of Bob Alexander's A Moment with Bob. We did some research today and found out that we had read 51 of his moments on this program starting way back in June of 2007. And, one of my favorites, I'm not going to do the whole thing, but it's just a few sentences that I got to share with you. When we come back, it's calibrating current political rules and standards. It's very quick. But maybe you'll remember it. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
Your pearls used to sue.
Hey, truth seekers, here's the truth speaker, Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. Okay, so this was Bob Alexander wrote this. It was part of one of his essays from March 15th of 08. Here's a little excerpt from it. If you're a Republican, you and your father-in-law can be out-and-out traitors plotting to overthrow the government. You can collaborate with the Nazis, your assets seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act, and you can still be elected to the United States Senate. Your son can be elected to the presidency of the United States for one term, and your grandson can be elected to the same office for two terms, if you're a Republican. If you're a Democrat, your loyalty and patriotism toward this country can be impugned because of your middle name, the father you last saw when you were 10 years old, and because you don't wear an American flag lapel pin manufactured in communist China. Sometimes you just have to stand back in awe after gazing into the seemingly unplumbable depths of Republican hypocrisy. But if somehow a representation of this Republican hypocrisy could be made physically manifest, it should, it must be, put on exhibit somewhere, perhaps in a museum or some other appropriate venue, right next to the world's largest turd. That was one of my favorites, too, frankly. Yeah, you know, you can be George W. Bush, or the Bush crime family. You know, people still say, why do you call it a crime family? Oh, please. You know, Grandpa Bush tried to collaborate with Hitler and did a pretty good job. And then his son becomes president and his grandson becomes president twice after stealing elections. The Bush crime family is a crime family. When I watched this hug fest with in Texas today, little excerpts of Barack Obama on the same stage with George Herbert Walker Bush, that kind of tore it for me. Does anybody know, is Obama out of Texas yet? Let's hope he gets out of there quickly. But, you know, for Obama to be hanging around, my grandma used to say, you know, you're known by the company you keep. Lie down with dogs, get up with fleas, you know, stuff like that. What the hell? Oh, well. What else we got here? Yeah, Barack Obama. President Obama went to New Orleans for the first time as president. When did he do that? Was that today? No, yesterday. On Thursday, he went to visit a charter school and to hold a town hall meeting. And he told the people there that he's committed to helping them continue to rebuild. Well, then, I mean, it's been 4 years. Of course, it wasn't his presidency. It wasn't his hurricane. It was George W. Bush's. Anyway, Obama saw the destruction on the Gulf Coast and observed that it was not just caused by natural disaster. It was also the failure of government at every level. He said, quote, "We will not forget about New Orleans, and we are not going to forget about the Gulf Coast. Together, we will rebuild this region, and we will rebuild it stronger than before," end quote. Okay, starting when? Louisiana Governor Paiush Jindal attended. So did Senator Mary Landrieu and New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin. Those three names I just mentioned should go straight to hell. Do not pass go. Do not collect the $1,000. Just get the hell out of town, all three of them. And then there was a fourth grade boy named Tyron Scott who asked the president the last question during the question and answer session of the program. Here's what he said. Why do people hate you? And why? Aren't they supposed to love you if God is love? The crowd applauded as Obama laughed and patted young Master Tyron on the shoulder. And he said, quote, "First of all, I did get elected president, so not everybody hates me. I got a whole lot of votes." And then he said, "A lot of it is what's called politics, where one party wins. Where once a party wins, the other party feels like they've got to poke you a little bit to keep you on your toes. So you shouldn't take it too seriously," end quote. Really? Is that what you, that's what you told this young boy who was asking you a question from the bottom of his heart? Why do people hate you? And Barack Obama stands there and says, "Oh, come on now, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. They don't hate me. It's just one political party in charge. And, you know, they like to poke you a little bit." Poke you a little bit? Why didn't you tell the boy that some of them want to shoot you a little bit, that they are sick sons of bitches, that they are all white folk? No, we're not allowed to say that. You were in Louisiana today, Mr. President, where a justice of the peace yesterday or a couple of days ago said, I'm not going to marry this couple because one's white and one's black. Can't do that. Of course, I can use my bathroom. Jesus, God. President went on, he said, quote, but people are worried about their own lives. A lot of people are losing their jobs right now. They're losing their health care. They lost their homes to foreclosure. They're feeling frustrated. When you're president of the United States, you got to deal with all of it. You get some of the credit when things are going good, but when things are going bad, you get some of the blame. But you didn't have anything to do with this. And then he finished up by saying, but that's all right. I'm a pretty tough guy. Are you a tough guy? You look pretty tough. So you just got to keep on going, even when folks are criticizing you, when you know you're doing it for other people. Well, that's good. Again, regardless of what I think of Barack Obama's politics and his willingness to be rolled, even by members of his own party, you got to give him credit. I give him credit on two levels. He's one hell of a speaker. He seems to be one of those people that my grandma used to tell me about. And those are the people that if you can't say something good about somebody, don't say anything. That seems to be Barack Obama's philosophy. I guess that's why he's president and not me, because I would have said to young master Tyron Scott, let me tell you something, son. There are people in this country who are goddamn psychopaths. They want to see me die. They'd like to see you die because of your skin color. They're crazy sons of bitches, and that's the reason I travel with the Secret Service, young Master Tyron, because if they come near me, I'll have my bodyguards put a bullet through their heads. Now, that would have been more honest, wouldn't it?
Is the Isle.
Seven past the hour, somebody sent me an email and said, come on, Mike, be charitable. When people are screwing up these questions, give them the podcast subscription anyway. No, come on, it's a contest. You know, you got to work a little bit. I think the story that got to me the most this week, the most egregious waste of television time from my perspective and probably yours, but from the broadcaster's point of view, it was wonderful drama. Oh, there it is. And that was the balloon story. Which is rapidly deteriorating into just one more, you know, give me my 15 minutes of fame type story for these people. But, you know, when you stop and think that I think the balloon story on CNN, had about 2.5 hours the other day, 2.5 hours of, wall to wall coverage with all kinds of experts. Oh God. Imagine if you had 2.5 hours on any topic. You know, CNN, the Daily Show did a real good job of this, but CNN always has their anchor people say, well, we have to leave it there now. Well, we have to leave it there now. You know, why? Why do you have to leave it there now when you're talking about Afghanistan or you're talking about Israel-Palestine or you're talking about the lying sons of bitches in this country that make health care look like something that's going to kill people, when you're or the swine flu vaccine or this or that? Oh, I have to leave it there now. But 2.5 hours of a goddamn balloon? Two and a half hours of a balloon. Oh, my God. Probably one of the reasons they did that is, first of all, the supervising producers of MSNBC, CNN, and I would assume Fox. I don't go to Fox. You'd have to have a gun to my head to get me. Well, that wouldn't work either. But I would assume that the reason the supervising producers of all the afternoon time on these cable networks, they look at that story and they think, okay, let me think here. There's a chance, albeit slim, that the bottom of that container underneath that balloon will pop open and the boy will fall out. Oh, let's keep the cameras on that one. God damn, can you imagine? And what they're really thinking about is, can you imagine if that did happen and the boy did fall out, but CNN, for example, had cut away to talk about the trying to negotiate something with Iran, and MSNBC and Fox didn't, and MSNBC and Fox had the video, the live video of the little boy tumbling 4,000 feet and splattering on the ground. CNN supervising producer for that program would probably have been fired. You let that get away? What did you go to? Iran? You went to Afghanistan? You went to that story about the ROTC trying to get its filthy fingers, the army, into middle school? You went to that story? And the second story is one that I don't know who broke it, but it was on this program the other night, and that was about the couple in New Orleans, a mixed-race couple that couldn't get married. Well, they got married today. I think they got married today or yesterday. And that has gotten more airtime. I mean, to me, that was just one little throwaway story. I mean, it wasn't throwaway to this couple, you know, to be slammed in the face, kicked in the solar plexus by this little cheesy two-bit justice of the peace. Well, I don't marry mixed couples. You can pee in my bathroom, but I got piles of black friends. You want to see them? Out here and back. Look, see them all stacked up there like cordwood? I got piles of them. They were my friends. I had to kill them, you know, because they're Negroes. And, I'm a white justice of the... Oh, my God. So all the airtime about this couple... It's a kicker story. It's a story you put at the end of your newscast. Say, oh, by the way, racism is still alive and well in certain parishes in South L.A. South L.A. is Louisiana, of course. Southern Louisiana, where they like to eat things that you and I probably wouldn't touch with a stick. Them goddamn crayfish. You ever seen one of those things? Woo! Those mud spiders. No. I see what you're going to do. You're going to try to write me an email and tell me about how good they are in barbecue sauce and with popcorn or something. Don't. They're insects. Anyway, I digress. So that little story, I mean, little in big context of things, not little to the couple. I grant you that. Not little to the couple. So all this airtime. Where was there a great big discussion? You know, going back to the bubble, of the airplane, or what the hell was it? The flying saucer Mylar balloon thing. Could you imagine if they would have had 2.5 hours on CNN, MSNBC, and the garbage network, about this conference at University of Chicago where the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations is advocating a nuclear war? He's advocating the annihilation of everybody on Earth because he is a sick son of a bitch. And this was a guy George Bush appointed to be our ambassador to the United Nations. How about 2.5 hours on that? How about 2.5 hours maybe on the people who are desperately trying to maintain their homes? And why Barack Obama has not given $700 billion to them instead of these goddamn filthy predatory banks on Wall Street? How about 2.5 hours on that? No. We get a balloon. A freaking balloon. This comes from Canada, from Salan Ali, who writes, thanks, Mike. I congratulate the President of the United States for winning the prestigious Nobel Peace Prize. Mike, I'm a citizen of Canada. And the majority of Canadians love President Obama. The speech the president made in Cairo was one speech I will never forget. Millions and millions of mainstream Muslims watched that speech. And it was a day and night. It was a day and night. It was what he's trying to say here. It was like the difference between day and night between former presidents and President Obama. President Obama paid tribute to the Muslim communities about their contributions to humanity, math, medicine, etc. I, as a Muslim, have a great respect for President Obama. Yes, I would like to see him do more, but I am a realist. I just want to tell Americans you are lucky to have a leader like President Obama. It would have been a disaster for the world and you Americans if McCain would have won the presidency. Congratulations, Mr. President, Salan Ali. Yeah, he gives good speech, doesn't he? And I think, you know, in a speech like that, like the one he gave in Cairo, I think he means it. You know, that Pink Floyd album, what is it? A moment, not momentary lapse of reason, but the one that has the song "Keep on Talking." It was a Division Bell. It's from Division Bell. The song about "Keep on Talking." And then we have John Bolton, who suggests at a meeting of intellectuals at the University of Chicago, for Christ's sake, that Israel should attack Iran and destroy it with nuclear weapons. You have that on the one hand. On the other hand, you have Obama trying to open dialogue, trying to talk. You know, when you're talking to people, when you're actually dialoguing with somebody, if that's the proper use of that word, which I doubt, but if you're talking back and forth with somebody, there's less chance. There's less chance of misunderstanding. And if there is a misunderstanding, the two sides can say, wait a second, did you just say what I think I said? And then the other person would say, no, that's not what I said. Here's what I said. Oh, you mean that? Yes, that's what I mean. Oh, I see. Okay. So you really don't want to come over here and nuke us. No. So you don't really want to not open up your nuclear facilities to international inspection. No. We already said, come on over, take a look. Yeah, right. All right. I think I have one of our listeners, Tom in Daytona, has come up with what may have been the quid pro quo for Barack Obama where it concerned the Nobel Peace Prize. We're going to share that with you when we come. Because everybody's been, you know, walk around and scratch their heads. Oh, did he do that? He hadn't done nothing yet. Well, they decided on him 9 days after he was elected. Did they really? I don't know that to be true, but I think Tom and Daytona may have an answer. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Of the Mike Malloy program is brought to you by It's Up to Us Alone, featuring Ed Asner. Go to usalone.com for information on where to hear the debut of this dramatic new radio play in your area.
Enough is enough, is enough, is enough. Open your eyes, time to wake up.
22 past the hour. All right, as promised. So, and by the way, podcast trivia when we come back to the next break. This is from Tom in Daytona. Dear Mike, the withdrawal of the First Strike missile shield in Eastern Europe may have been the quid pro quo for the Obama Nobel Peace Prize. The missile shield in Eastern Europe would have been the coup de grace for the almost dead dogma regarding mutual assured destruction, or MAD, deterrence theory, the underpinning of the now defunct ABM treaty. anti-ballistic missile treaty. The fact is that strategic theorists still say, still believe in mutual assured destruction and abhor first strike instability, especially in Europe, although it is now heresy to say so. This has to do with a misperception of Rumsfeld's revolution in military affairs. The so-called revolution in military affairs is economic and political, rather than a legitimate strategic theory. The putative strategy follows the money and the politics of money. The politics are the replacement of core military functions with corporate contract functions, whether it is providing hot meals to soldiers or building missiles or satellite weapons, which are inherently destabilizing and dangerous to national security. The goal is transferring or converting government resources to corporate bank accounts. This is why the number of active duty regular troops is actually historically quite small, if not a record, during wartime when the military expenditures are at an historical high. The revolution is at its most basic the unjust and unjustified enrichment of the Pentagon's civilian corporate carpetbagging class at everyone else's awful expense. The fact is that the destabilization represented by first strike enabling missile shields goes beyond the interminable but relatively limited warfare envisioned by Orwell as so necessary for the totalitarian state and puts an undesired terminal point on the warfare function. Also of note in the revolution in military affairs is the proliferation of states within states, or the apparent never-ending rollout of corporate security organizations complete with unidentified and unaccountable intelligence, police, and military functions. The latter is well within the description of organizational metastases consuming the traditional state institutions explored by Hannah Arendt in her book, The Origins of Totalitarianism. The true party member is a defense contractor functionary working at an anti-terrorism fusion center, bringing the security concerns of the Afghan-Pakistan conflict to your local sheriff's office so that First Amendment activities at home may be identified and chilled or cultivated into a full-blown war on terror extravaganza. What do you think? Tom in Daytona. I completely agree. I absolutely agree. The transfer of government functions, especially where it concerns war making, where it concerns empire building, as rickety and as laughable as empire building by the United States now is, transferring those functions to private corporations is a clear example of what we've been talking about in this program for the past, 9 years, 10 years? The corporatization of this country. We are not a representative democracy at this point, or a democratic republic. Say it any way you want to. I really don't care. But our votes are useless. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean stay home? Well, I guess. Because if our votes are useless, what is the point in going to the polls when we know that we're going to be voting on machines that will give the result wanted by the corporatocracy? What's the point? I'm serious. What's the point? I don't advocate not exercising one's franchise of voting. I mean, what else do we have? But when the vote is meaningless, why go through a meaningless kind of marionette-like action every election day? Oh, I think I'm going to go vote. Oh, good for you. Step right up. Step right up, Mr. or Ms. Voter. Here. Click that button. There you go. Thank you. Goodbye. If that's meaningless because the voting machines are controlled by just one more tentacle of the corporatocracy, then what's the point of voting? So what do we do, Uncle Mike? Don't vote until we have paper ballots.
But Uncle Mike, if we don't vote, you've said it before, politics hates a vacuum. And the corporatocracy will move in.
The corporatocracy has already moved in. So it's up to us to demand. You know, we got to get, since we can't demand the great big events, We can't demand an end to the war. We can't demand an end to foreclosures. Let's demand that our states give us back paper ballots. Is that a good starting point? It's time once again for what? Oh, podcast trivia here on the Molloy Program, where you get to win a free one-year subscription to commercial-free downloads of the Molloy Program for your podcast, your telephone, your whatever you want to download it to, your hearing apparatus, your glass eyeball. It really doesn't matter. Catherine is in Tucson, Arizona. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, delighted to get another chance.
Okay, are you ready to really, really, really get, you got to get this one, all right?
I knew all three of the others.
Oh, you did?
Yes, that was very frustrating.
Okay, here we go. Mm-hmm. Why did Paul Wolfowitz, remember him?
Yes.
Why did Paul Wolfowitz resign as head of the World Bank? Was it because, A, he helped his female companion score a $60,000 pay raise and promotion, then tried to cover it up? B, he embezzled funds from charities, then tried to cover it up? C, assisted in the outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame? Or D, excessive comb licking?
Well, he's a Republican, so it's got to be A.
It's A! Oh, my God! All right. Thanks, Catherine. You did it.
Thank you.
That's very good. All right, let me put you on hold, and Kathy will pick up and get the necessary information so that you will now have a free one-year subscription to Molloy Podcast Downloads. Let's see. Wasn't that easy? Okay. All right. We, as you know, Kate Petrini is our education affairs correspondent, and she periodically sends us missives from the educational swamp in which she does a damn good job, and her students thoroughly, truly are getting educated, because Kay is one of those teachers that a lot of folks wish they had when they were in high school. For the courses that Kay teaches. She teaches at a private school, which doesn't make any difference from teaching at a public school, except she's a little bit protected from having to put up with crazy people. You know, the parents that say, "You're going to read what? Heather has two daddies. Oh, no, you're not." You know, that kind of craziness. But occasionally Kay sends me something that has nothing to do with her function as education affairs correspondent, and she did yesterday, and I want to share it with you. She writes, "Hi, Mike. Almost every morning I listen to the New York Times Front Page podcast, which summarizes the major news stories in about 6 minutes. I don't have time to read the paper until later in the day, and this allows me to skim for current events topics to discuss in my classes. I'm going to try to replicate what I experienced this morning by writing this to you." Now, what she does, she has what the podcast says and then her internal monologue. Podcast. "The White House likes a health insurance proposal by Senator Olympia Snow, which would allow states to offer a public option if certain conditions are met." Internal monologue. Olympia Snow? The Democrats have a majority. But the White House is looking at a proposal submitted by Republican Olympia Snow? And where have we heard that old line about states' rights before? Oh, yeah. "On all of the other civil or human rights issues this country has faced, that's where we heard it. Sure, let's leave it to the states. They have such great track records of honoring people's rights, don't they?" Podcast. "Soldiers often return to old battlefields to honor comrades and exorcise demons. Vietnam vets can now get travel packages tailored to the places they were stationed. And Iraq vets are going back to scenes where they were maimed on a 7-day tour called Operation Proper Exit.
It is the first time such a program has been launched during wartime. Internal monologue. Tours of Vietnam battlefields? Operation Proper Exit? Sharon Gordy, military affairs correspondent. We need your insight. Podcast. Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann will be featured in the 2010 calendar of Great American Conservative Women. Democrats criticize her for spreading reckless lies, but Republicans draw glowing comparisons between Bachmann and the former governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin. Internal monologue. Glowing comparisons to Sarah Palin? Isn't that oxymoronic? Are these people on drugs? Podcast. The New York Stock Exchange is getting smaller and losing its influence. Rivals are creating private markets that are invisible to regulators. They trade in secrecy. Internal monologue. To paraphrase, Great Britain dominated the 19th century. The United States ran the show in the 20th century. And the 21st century belongs to China. Podcast. Scores on nationwide math tests increased only slightly for 8th graders and not at all for 4th graders under No Child Left Behind. Internal monologue. Do you think that maybe teachers should be consulted on education issues for a change? Most teachers were opposed to No Child Left Behind, yet the current Secretary of Education in the Obama administration has incorporated key elements of that legislation into the Obama administration's Race to the Top program. Podcast. Senior Treasury officials want big banks to repay bailout money sooner. A growing number of banks are well-positioned to pay back. Treasury officials suspect that they are holding on to government money simply because it's cheaper than money from private sources. Internal monologue. It's okay for banks and corporations to take government money and keep it when they are in a position to pay it back, but it's not okay for American citizens who need things like health care, education, unemployment, compensation, and so forth, to do the same? Mike, as you have said many times on the program, it's like we're living in an insane asylum. Only there aren't any walls anymore. Okay. Yeah, I have that same problem. I subscribe to the New York Times online news digest every morning just for the hell of it, because I get home delivery and so on and so forth, so it's free. But I will be going about my day, and I'll hear something that is supposed to be a story in a newscast. It may be, if I'm in the car, I'm listening to Sirius. I may be listening to CNN or NPR or whatever. If I'm at home, you know, and drift by a television, we have at least one television on at all times in this household, because I guess that was my idea in case, you know, the neocons launch a coup attempt against President Obama. I don't have to wait for somebody to call me and say, run, hide, it's starting. You know, I'll see it myself. So I will hear news stories, little bits and snatches on any given day, you know, and they're, it's weird. They're little little disembodied, disconnected phrases and sentences, that kind of stand out against the background noise that a television is when you're at home and not really sitting down in front of it watching it. You know, you'll hear the noise. Mostly what you hear are the jingles for the commercials. But occasionally, you know, a phrase will stand out. Flying saucer with a boy in it. What? 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 Oh, it's that goddamn balloon story again. Ugh. Four more Americans dead in Afghanistan. Oh, no. You know, stuff like that. But some of the stuff that I hear, as Kay points out, you know, you hear it and then immediately triggers your internal dialogue. And your internal dialogue says, you know, that's hogsnut. Those are lies. That's misinformation or disinformation. Or as CNN says, well, we have to leave it there now. Oh, well. Four more American troops died in a bombing in southern Afghanistan today. According to U.S. military.
and a UN-backed group in that country completed most of its investigation into whether the level of fraud in the August presidential election would require runoff. Do you hear that? Whether the level of fraud where our puppet, our little rat bastard, our little former Unocal lobbyist, if the fraud was deep and wide enough to warrant a runoff. Huh? Now, anybody who cares in Afghanistan, and I question whether anyone cares about this kind of horse crap. Well, we get to vote. Oh, okay. What is vote? Anyone who does care in that country, when they see that the puppet installed by the new occupier, they've had many occupiers, we're just the newest one. When they see that the puppet installed by the new occupier stole so much that even the new occupier is a little bit embarrassed. And the new occupier says, well, we've been checking the level of the theft. And if it's above, pick a number, 70%, then we're going to have another election. We are going to have another election. We are going to dictate to the Afghan people that they must have another election. We will decide that. We will tell the Afghan people to line up once again because our puppet stole too much. I mean, does that register in your mind as a reason to be sending our young men and women over there to die?
The voice inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. So while our soldiers and Marines are dying, being blown into pieces in Afghanistan, and while our military, raising it from the personal to the corporate, while our military is destroying human lives of Afghans and Pakistanis and whoever else gets in the way. While that's going on, the UN-backed panel of experts in that country has almost decided whether or not to order another election to give at least a dusting of legitimacy to the reign of our puppet, Hamid Karzai. Afghanistan's ambassador to the U.S. says he expects a second round vote will be required. Yes, he does. Well, what else is he going to say, right? Now, while the vote fraud is going on and our people are being blown into pieces, and Stanley McChrystal, the general there, who is a war lover and an assassin and wants more blood, more gore, more death, more destruction. He wants his name in the history books. He can't get another star. He got his fourth star for taking over command in Afghanistan. So all he can get now is guts and glory. He can't advance any further. The miserable son of a bitch ought to resign, retire, I should say, and go draw his pension. But McChrystal is one of those bloodthirsty generals who never have enough. They can bathe in human blood, and it's never enough. So while McChrystal is demanding anywhere from 10,000 to 80,000 more troops, Barack Obama and his advisors are reviewing their entire Afghanistan war strategy. Now, we spent considerable time last week going over, I even shared with you a letter written, it's in an open letter to the president, written or published, I should say, in the Nation magazine about all the reasons to to not do this, to get out, to let this be. But I think we all know that Barack Obama is not going to do this. The parallels between the decision Kennedy had to make in 1963, right before he was gunned down in Texas, and the decisions that Obama has to make here in 2009, the parallels are so obvious and so frightening. But who was it? I'm trying to remember. I saw this today. I think it was in the New York Times. It might have been. Somebody writing an op-ed piece, was going through the letters or the papers of, Senator, Richard Russell, former senator from Georgia, who was a mentor to Lyndon Johnson when Johnson was, a senator. Richard Russell had in his papers a letter to him, I believe I got this right, from a combat veteran who was in, you know, the command and control range, colonel on up, I guess, who said, I think I got this right, who said, we should not get involved in a land war in Vietnam. It's the second worst place on earth to commit American troops. The worst being Afghanistan. Now, that was in 1964. It was right before, I believe, Lyndon Johnson, either tricked or not tricked, bought into the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and ordered a massive buildup. It was at that point that I got my draft notice. In 64, late 64, I believe. So here we are again. Here we are again. Is there some reason? And now that was published in the New York Times today. Is there some reason why that doesn't hold still today? Don't get involved in Vietnam. It's the second worst place that we could commit American ground troops. The worst being Afghanistan. What do you suppose it is that is stopping Barack Obama from coming on television one night, if they can clear away the balloons and the interracial couple that can't get married and all this other stuff, if they can just clear a spot so the president can come on and say, okay, listen, after sitting down with my national security team, after listening to people who are dedicated to the preservation of this country, as a nation state, not as an imperialist power, I have come to, this conclusion. I am ordering the beginning now of a complete and total withdrawal from Afghanistan and a continuation of the plans for a withdrawal from Iraq, and we shall never, ever, 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 ever again get involved in this kind of madness because we don't have to. Oh God, isn't that a fantasy? Isn't that some kind of a nocturnal remission, huh? Isn't that crazy? To expect a president of the United States to weigh in the balance history, politics, the declining American empire, the absolute necessity to get the hell out of the 140 countries that we have troops in, to come home, to rebuild this poor, sad, tired, ready to die society, to give the middle finger as often as possible to these filthy Republicans, these degenerate conservatives who want us to be destroyed so that either Jesus or Nazism will come to this country, maybe both at the same time. Wouldn't that be amazing to see a president of the United States? Consider history, consider real politics, to consider economics, consider the complete corporatization of everything, how close we are, and just say, no, I've decided not to wage war. I'm going to acknowledge the fact that I was given the Nobel Peace Prize. Welcome back. It is just about 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program. I hate to see us get involved in another quagmire military situation, this time Afghanistan. Don't you? Think about that for a minute. The United States military in Afghanistan. I mean, Michael in Roswell, New Mexico writes regarding military corporatization. Michael writes, want something really scary to contemplate? Now that the major national nuclear weapons labs are under joint university corporate control, there's not one single aspect of nuclear weapons in which corporations do not have a financial stake, from design to manufacture to assembly to testing. Additionally, James Manford estimates that as much as 70% of the National Security Agency and the CIA's workforce is now contracted from corporations. You know, I just feel silly. I really do feel silly as hell. Especially for sitting here night after night after night talking about the coming corporatization of America, the coming fascist state or corporatist state, whatever you want to call it. It's just silly. I mean, it's already here. What did Bob Alexander write the other night? Was it Michael in New York? You know, the majority, I think it was Bob, the majority of people in this country want single payer health care or the private option or public option, whatever you want to call it. Let's just call it single payer. The majority of the people in this country want that. But we are not going to get it. So the answer is, why not? Now, the academic answer would be, well, Molloy, there was a time in this country when the majority of people wanted to retain slavery. But we're not a democracy. We're a democratic republic. Okay, that's fine. But is this not a little bit different from slavery? I don't know. Is it? The majority of the people in this country do not want us to go into Afghanistan because the majority of the people in this country don't have a goddamn clue as to why we're there. This is 2009, almost 2010, nearly 9 years ago, 19 people, 15 of whom were from Saudi Arabia, none of whom were from Afghanistan, came to this country, if you believe the official story, and bombed the Christ out of us and killed 3,000 people. And that's why we're in Afghanistan? Why don't we invade Bolivia? How about Iceland? And the answer is, well, there's terrorists in Afghanistan, Mike. Really? Really? Still? What did we have on the program the other night? An article that there may be experts. I mean, people that know this stuff. Not you and me. We don't know squat. But people who know this stuff. There's what, 100? Al-Qaeda-ets left? And we're fearful of that. We're going to other countries. Listen to what did I just do with that? There were more civilian deaths again caused by us in Afghanistan. Where is it? It's right here. The NATO-led coalition said two militants fired from a two-story building and troops returned fire, killing a pair of gunmen. The coalition said in a statement, quote, when the joint force entered the building, they discovered two civilians who subsequently died from their wounds. It is unclear if the enemy militants or the joint force are responsible for the deaths, end quote. However, the police chief of this village, town, said the dead were all civilians from the same family. A native of this village said the operation began late Thursday when U.S. and Afghan forces raided several houses overnight, blowing apart doors and windows with explosives. This witness said four civilians were killed in the operation and several were beaten. I mean, this goes on and on and on. This has been going on for we're in the eighth year of this invasion. This expeditionary force of U.S. troops that is now an occupation. What else would you call it, Truth Seeker? We are in the eighth year of this. And after 8 years, what are the people that run your life and my life, what are they talking about? They're talking about doubling the force that we have there, doubling the number of troops. You want to hear something weird? Where is that? This is, first of all, a veteran Army officer who has served in both the Afghanistan and Iraq wars warns in an analysis now circulated in Washington that the counterinsurgency strategy urged by General Stanley McChrystal is likely to strengthen the Afghan insurgency. And this Army veteran officer calls for withdrawal of the bulk of U.S. combat forces from the country, Afghanistan, over 18 months. It's a 63-page paper representing his personal views. But it reflects conversations with other officers who have served in Afghanistan. The primary author is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis. He argues that it is already too late for U.S. forces to defeat the insurgency. This was written by Gareth Porter, Interpress Service. Lieutenant Colonel Davis writes, quote, many experts in and from Afghanistan warn that our presence over the past 8 years has already hardened a meaningful percentage of the population into viewing the United States as an army of occupation, which should be opposed and resisted, end quote. He adds that sending those additional troops, 40, 50, 60,000 that McChrystal has reportedly requested, quote, is almost certain to further exacerbate the problem. Now, this guy is not, you know, a desk jockey. He was a liaison officer between the Combined Forces Command Afghanistan and the Central Command in 2005, just as the Afghan insurgency was becoming a significant problem for U.S. military. In that assignment, he consulted with the top U.S. officers and staff of the Combined Forces Command. He also commanded a U.S. military transition team on the Iraqi border with Iran in 2008-2009. So, you know, the people who understand this, from a military, from a strategic, and in some cases even tactical point of view, but especially from a strategic point of view, the combat people, the people who have been there, not the war lovers like McChrystal, but the people who have been there, who understand all the aspects of an operation like this, the invasion aspects, the occupation aspects, the historical aspects, the tribal aspects, the fraudulent aspects, the imperialist, all of it, are advising us to get out. So, what are we doing? Now, here's one of the reasons we are not getting out. $400 per gallon gas. $400 per gallon, not $2.50. $400 per gallon. This is from one of the news agencies. The Pentagon says pays an average of $400 to put a gallon of fuel into a combat vehicle or aircraft in Afghanistan. $400 a gallon. Pentagon officials have told the House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee that a gallon of fuel costs the military $400 by the time it arrives in the remote locations of Afghanistan where U.S. troops operate. Representative John Murtha, Democrat PA, the chairman of the House Appropriations Defense Panel, said in an interview with The Hill newspaper, quote, it is a number that we were not aware of, and it is worrisome. Murtha writes, when I heard that figure from the Defense Department, we started looking into it. $400 a gallon for gasoline. We'll be right back.
time to practice your synchronized screaming. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. $400 a gallon gasoline. The Pentagon Controller General's office provided that statistic to Murtha's committee when it was asked for a breakdown of why every 1,000 troops deployed to Afghanistan costs $1 billion. I don't know if that's a month or a year. This is what the Obama administration uses to calculate the cost of sending more troops there. Any additional troops, any additional operations in Afghanistan will have to be paid for through another supplemental spending bill next year. How many supplemental spending bills have we had since the Bush crime family took over? Dozens? Afghanistan is very lacking in infrastructure. They have very challenging geography, to put it mildly. The number of roadside bomb attacks, the IEDs, is increasing exponentially. It's a logistical nightmare for the U.S. military. It's landlocked. It has no seaports. What airports it does have are primarily rutted garbage or military airports. Very few navigable roads. Why do you need a road when your primary mode of transportation are animals? The nearest port is in Karachi, Pakistan. That's where fuel for U.S. troops is shipped. And from there, commercial trucks. Commercial trucks, corporations, transport the fuel through Pakistan into Afghanistan. One of the most expensive ways, according to TheHill.com, one of the most expensive ways to supply fuel is by transporting it in huge bladders carried by helicopters. And the amount that can be flown in at one time can barely satisfy the need for fuel. The Marines in Afghanistan, for example, reportedly run through 800,000 gallons of fuel a day. 800,000 gallons of fuel a day. A day. Now, if you multiply that times $400 a gallon, you get $320 million a day. I guess that answers my question about the $1 billion figure. A third of $1 billion a day in fuel cost? And that reflects the logistical challenges of doing these operations. $320 million a day. Who do you suppose is making the money? Where do you suppose the money is going? Now, the official response to any inquiries is, well, it's a war zone, and in order to transport fuel into or through a primitive country like Afghanistan in a war zone, you have to get people or corporations who are willing to do this, and it costs a lot of money. Corporations. It's not the U.S. military transporting this fuel. As Michael said in his earlier email, and as you probably know, the corporatization of warfare is almost complete. What in the hell? Man. Well, what do you suppose Barack Obama is going to decide? What did John Kennedy decide where it concerned Vietnam? If you get beyond the mythology, beyond the lies, beyond the historical obfuscations of what went on in those discussions with Kennedy, even though he had some world-class warmongers involved with him, McGeorge Bundy, Robert McNamara, Curtis LeMay, I mean, just on and on. I mean, people who were just frothing at the mouth for a global nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union. and saw Vietnam as a great launching point. And if you get past, or if you read historical records that are not, that have not been corrupted by that garbage, if you get to the point where you understand that Kennedy, honestly, truthfully, no kidding, wanted to reduce the U.S. commitment, the only reason we were there is because of the French. It was the collapse of empire. What do 58,000 dead Americans and 2 million dead Indochinese and God knows how many wounded Americans, what is that translated into as far as the security of the United States is concerned? Abso-goddamn-lutely nothing. So there was Kennedy. Here's Obama. There's Kennedy saying, I've got to study this. Okay, I've decided we're going to get out of there. And what happened then? They killed him.
Here you don't meet us. Say that the war here is over, but more of us die every day. And I don't know why we are fighting. Was it all just a lie anyway? Like they say. See, Mr. President.
Oh, no! It's time once again for podcast trivia on the Molloy program, wherein you can win a one-year subscription to downloads of this program, podcast downloads, commercial-free. And we like to give them away because we get lots of people who contribute lots of free subscriptions. We also are looking for people to buy subscriptions to the podcast downloads. It is very important. You can get information on how to do that by going to MikeMolloy.com. John is in Atlanta. John, do you want to play trivia?
Let's see what we can do.
Okay, let's give it a shot. Let me find a good one for you here. Do you listen to the program regularly?
Quite often.
Okay. We did that one.
Give me an easy one.
Okay. What was Harkin Energy? Was it A, a front organization for money laundering by the Gambino crime family? Was it B, one of the many companies Dick Cheney ran that improperly influenced energy policy in the U.S.? Was it C, a company that developed an electric car and whose senior research analyst was found dead in a suspicious suicide? Or was it D, a small Texas energy company involved in an insider trading scandal with board member and future head of the Bush crime family, George W. Bush?
Now, Mike, you know I want to automatically choose D, but don't say anything. But B sounded pretty good.
Well, which one do you want?
D first, right?
D?
Yeah.
Like A, B, C, D?
A, B, C, D.
D, you win! A small Texas energy company. Now, let me just give you a little follow-up. Paul, a member of the company's board of directors, George W. Bush, sold stock in Harkin on the 22nd of June, 1990, shortly before the company announced substantial losses. The transaction resulted in U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission investigation of probable insider trading. But it didn't matter. He went on to be handed the presidency in 2000. All right, John, don't hang up. After we talk about what you called in for, Kathy will get your name and how to do this. All right?
That sounds great. Now, before I start talking, I just want you to repeat B. You remember what B was?
Yeah, one of the companies Tricky Dick Cheney ran that improperly influenced energy policy in the United States.
Now, what company would that be?
That would probably be Halliburton. There's a whole list of these you could choose from. These sons of bitches corrupted everything, didn't they?
They sure did.
Oh, man. All right.
Okay, now, the reason why I want to call, first off, I wanted to say, that, my friend, God bless you, you are like the prophet Elijah. Now, the Bible says Elijah used to cuss. He was a hard-edged man. He wasn't afraid to stand up and talk to somebody. That's the way you are, my friend Mike Malloy.
Elijah?
Yes.
Isn't he the one that saw the spaceship? Or no, that was Ezekiel. Never mind. All right. No. Well, okay, I'll
Elijah was the one taken up by the whirlwind.
Oh, well, I thought maybe Elijah saw the Mylar balloon. I have no idea. But, John, I know you mean that as a compliment. Thank you. Now, the way you really, what you really called in for.
I'm just talking about that when I called you, I'm from Johnson City, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And in Jonesboro, Tennessee, the oldest town in Johnson City.
Right.
Part of my ancestry goes back to the first publication of the abolition of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
That has been, I mean, as we think about it, that's almost been 170 years ago.
Right.
A long time.
Right.
How far we've come, but yet... And, oh, Lord, I'd love to be talking to Russ Limbaugh face-to-face right now when I say this. But yet, how far behind that mentality still... They still want to make it the way that it was.
Sure.
One of the main problems is that I think the Old Boys Network has lost America. And so then when they say we need to get America back...
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're talking about.
Oh, sure. We talked about this the other night. When folks talk about, you know, returning to the original Constitution, that's crazy because the original Constitution didn't have those first 10 amendments that we now consider the Bill of Rights. That didn't exist. That's A. That's A, B, and C. D would be, black folk weren't even considered human. They were considered to be 3/5 of a human being. So when people talk about, well, I want to return to the original intent of the Constitution, that's the first clue to me that they don't know what they're talking about. And what they're doing is parroting something that they've heard from Hannity or Limbaugh or Beck or the rest of these people who also don't know what they're talking about historically or factually. They know what they're talking about where it concerns fomenting disorder and crisis and trouble and hatred in this country, but they don't know anything about the original Constitution. Or they do know. And are in kind of couched terms are suggesting that it would be good if black folk were considered 3/5 of a human being. It would be good if women didn't have the right to vote. You understand what I'm saying? So I certainly understand what you're saying.
I do. Now, Mike, I hate to say this because the fact of the matter is, I think you may know what I'm talking about. Now, when you hear all these people stand up for Rush in his last episode. They stand up and say, you know, I know that Russ is not a racist. No. Anybody like you and I, we're white. We've grown up in the white society. We've been around people who think that they've been around white people so they can speak freely. But yet when they go out in public and speak, they speak in code.
Right.
And so we know that what Russ Limbaugh says on his radio, I definitely do not consider myself a racist. Because I think of myself as black.
Now, wait a minute. He said that?
In my mind, I'm black.
He said, you're kidding.
I grew up with rock and roll. I grew up with soul music. I grew up with R&B. I'm a musician. I think of, when I write a song, I think of, how would Chuck Berry do this? How would Little Richard do this?
Right.
How would the Beatles do this? Who thought about the same thing? I think about Nat King Cole. I think about Charlie Parker. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, I do, but do you think about what it's like to have to step off the sidewalk when a white man walks by? Do you think about what it's like not to be able to vote? Do you think what it's like to have to go pee in a urinal designed that says colored on it? Do you think about what it's like not to be able to sit on the main floor of a theater? Do you think what it's like not to be able to eat in a restaurant? Come on, John. There's a hell of a lot more
more to being black than just, you know, enjoying music and appreciating Chuck Berry. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do, sir.
Okay.
And this is what my grandmother would say. My grandmother, who was a waitress back during the 40s, 50s,
right.
and 60s,
right.
what she used to tell me during that time period was, is that in the workplace, you couldn't talk about religion and you couldn't talk about politics. So for poor people during those days, the rich people, they had to say. They didn't want to hear what poor white people had to say, and they definitely didn't want to hear what poor black people had to say.
Well, I agree, and the only way that's changed now, John, and thanks, John, I appreciate your call. The only way that's changed is that now, John, you need to call back in so Kathy can get the information. Oh, Lord, I hung up too quick. All right, John, you need to get back in here if you can. I lost my train of thought. Oh, well, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. I didn't have anything to say. Jeff is in Los Angeles. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Pretty good. Just want to thank you for, I think it's 6 years now, of the only person who's even close to getting the Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld crime. It's just a criminal enterprise, period.
That's all it is.
It's amazing. Anyway, I'm not a 9/11 kind of lunatic, but I happened to be at home yesterday and turn on the stupid balloon thing.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing. One of the networks said, NORAD's on top of it. That wasn't their word. They said NORAD's been made aware. We're supposed to, are you laughing? Yeah, we're supposed to believe.
Right.
For an hour and a half on 9, and I'm not conspiracy buff. For an hour and a half on 9/11, the entire East Coast was undefended.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, sure.
They didn't know about it. They were looking the wrong way. Some planes went out. They were worried about an attack from the Soviet Union, which doesn't even exist.
Right.
Yet yesterday, they were on top of the balloon.
Sure, sure.
I mean, are we that stupid? Well, if we are that stupid, that's why we're in the state that we're in.
Well, we are that stupid. You know, we are that stupid. And you know, I am a 9/11 freakoid. You know, I've listened to all the stories. I've had people I really like and respect tell me I'm crazier than a loon to go there, to believe anything other than the official story.
Oh, no, the official story.
Yeah, it's, you know, and now the, you know, as we mentioned last week, the general counsel of the 9/11 commission said that the whole 9/11 report was a lie. Well, what the hell is it? Yeah, you know, what is a simple-minded man like me supposed to do when you know, I was told one thing by the 9/11 commission and now their general counsel says it was all a lie. Hey, I gotta leave there. Jeff, thank you, man. I appreciate you checking in. Take care.
It's about rich white men getting richer. It's about fear,
it's about fear
and
control
of those barrels of black gold.
Texas tea.
Yeah, step up, folks, to another war where we never really say what we're fighting for. It's easy to pretend we're defending our native soil. Put it in the headlines, I want to see it in big lights. Hello, it's about oil.
Thanks to the crew. Sharon Gordy, Bruce Enberg, Kay Petrini, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Ben Birch, and Kathy Bay, who's our executive producer. Guy's driving around the backwoods of Montana, and he sees a sign in front of a broken-down shanty-style house. The sign says, Talking Dog for Sale. He rings the bell, and the owner appears and tells him the dog's in the backyard. So the guy goes around to the backyard and sees a nice-looking lab retriever sitting there. You talk? He asks. Yeah, the lab replies. After the guy recovers from the shock of hearing a dog talk, he says, So, what's your story? The lab looks up and says, Well, I discovered I could talk when I was pretty young. I wanted to help the government, so I told the CIA. In no time at all, they had me jetting from country to country, sitting in rooms with spies and world leaders because no one figured a dog would be eavesdropping. I was one of their most valuable spies for 8 years running. But the jetting around really tired me out, and I knew I wasn't getting any younger, so I decided to settle down. I signed up for a job at the airport to do some undercover security, wandering near suspicious characters and listening in. I uncovered some incredible dealings and was awarded a batch of medals. Eventually, I got married, had a mess of puppies, and now I'm just retired. The guy's amazed. He goes back in and asks the owner what he wants for the dog. $10, the guy says. $10? This dog is amazing. Why on earth are you selling him so cheap? Because he's a damn liar. He never did any of that. Oh, God. Somebody just sent me that, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I know. You've heard it all before. You've heard that before, and it's, you know, Erica in Houston sent that, so, all right. Barbara is in California. Hey, Barbara.
Hi, Mike.
Hey.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. How about you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you. Just listening to you, I want to say one thing real quick. One time you read a little essay that I wrote to you. You read it on the air, and I realized I had finally arrived.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
I wrote a little essay to you and sent it, and you read it on the air.
Well, it must have been a good one.
Well, I was extremely flattered. But anyway, I just was listening to you talking about Vietnam, and I was remembering not too long ago I was getting my car worked on, and I was sitting in the waiting room, and a man was sitting there with me, and we were watching TV, and he started talking to me. We were talking about politics, and he said he had served in Vietnam. And then he said, you do know that Vietnam was about rubber. And I said, no, I had no idea that that was what it was about. And he said, yeah. He said, the French were there, you know, on behalf of Michelin, and then we came in, and he said Agent Orange was sprayed to kill the rubber trees so they wouldn't fall into the wrong hands. He said it wasn't to destroy the foliage, it was to kill the rubber trees. And I'd never known that.
Well, here, consider this. I got this from Michael earlier. The reasons for Vietnam were a bad mixture of profit expectation and ideology. The ideology, we understand, but the economics are something of which most Americans are unaware. Vietnam was the only country in the region at the time producing enough rice to feed itself and export. Vietnam had tin mines, natural rubber plantations, lots of cheap labor. The French had planned before World War II to make Vietnam the Riviera of Southeast Asia, so there was a potential for tourist currency, and oil in the South China Sea. The U.S. wanted to pick up where the French left off, and the first step was to have the CIA destabilize both North and South and ruin all chance for a U.N.-mandated unification election in 1956, and that's exactly what they did. So that's not far-fetched at all, Barbara.
Yeah. Yeah, I just never had heard that before, you know. I mean, I was young at the time. I really didn't know that much about Vietnam, but he just said it very matter-of-factly, and it surprised me, and I just wanted to call you up and...
Yeah, I don't think, you know, the justification for so many of the little wars that we fought, the so-called proxy wars, I guess is what the historians call it, the foreign policy historians, proxy wars between the United States and the Soviet Union, even if we weren't actively involved with troops, you know, whether it was Greece or Vietnam or anywhere in Central America or, you know, wherever it was during that 50 years subsequent to World War II and before the collapse of the Soviet Union. Those wars, we were taught, you and I, I'm sure you were taught the same thing as I, that these were battles against communism, when in fact, they may have been battles against communism, but they weren't waged for U.S. security. They were waged for U.S. corporations even back then.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any difference if and it didn't start then. It started before the Soviet Union even existed. It started before the Russian Revolution, and that was back at the time of our involvement in the Spanish-American War, when the United States sent troops to Nicaragua. We sent Marines into Nicaragua in, what, 1916? We sent troops into Guatemala in the 50s. We have always, every war that I can think of, even probably World War II, had to do with the economic interests of the United States, and very little to do with the struggle between totalitarianism or whatever and freedom and democracy. We've been lied to, Barbara.
Yes. Well, I'm glad that you're out there, Mike, trying to tell the truth.
Well, I appreciate you checking in tonight, okay?
Thank you. I appreciate you.
All right. Well, take care. You have a good weekend. That's it for us. I'll see you Monday. Don't forget, October 29th, big national strike, a stay-home day in the United States in protest of corporatism. We will have a rebroadcast on that day. I think the number of Americans participating so far, including Kathy and me, is up to 14. I'll see you Monday. Take care. Keep it lit. Oh, and have a great weekend, Kevin, Kenny, wherever you are. Individual results.